This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When Ciba Geigy and Union Carbide opened their chemical plants in Toms River, New Jersey, back in the 1950s, the town welcomed the new jobs and the economic boom that brought prosperity to the community. But soon the companies began dumping their toxic waste in leaky holding ponds and drums that began leaching into the water supply. Waste was even piped into the Atlantic Ocean, not far from a public beach. When children started developing cancer in the 1980s, residents began to worry and ask questions about the impact of this pollution on health. Our guest Dan Fagan writes about this toxic chemical legacy and the families, the scientists, activists, and medical personnel who forced a cleanup and a multi-million dollar settlement with affected families. The book is titled Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Dan Fagan is an associate professor of journalism and the director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Dan Fagan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Congratulations on your book.
Thanks a lot, Marty. It's great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Why did these companies want to set up shop in Toms River, New Jersey?
Well, they came to Toms River for a couple of reasons. The key ones were actually have to do with pollution, have to do with the environmental mess that they left behind. Toms River was a fairly remote location. We think of New Jersey now as a very densely populated state. But back in those days, Ocean County was the middle of nowhere, really. And there were some unique characteristics. The soil was sandy, sponge-like. So whatever you dumped in the soil in Toms River, it would just kind of go away, at least so they...
On the surface.
So they told themselves. And there was a little creek nearby, the Toms River, and so it had everything that they needed, privacy and a ready water source to make dyes. And dyes are a very messy, messy thing to make, as they already knew from the previous places that they had polluted.
And what kind of dyes? Dyes for what?
Well, the plant that was set up at Toms River at one point was the largest dye manufacturing facility in the U.S. And it really made dyes for all sorts of reasons, military uniforms, paints, anything that needed color. The odds were good that at least in the 50s and 60s, it came from the Toms River Chemical Company. The color part did.
And were these good jobs? I mean, were these good paying jobs for the people living in the Toms River area?
Yeah, they absolutely were. I mean, this was really the only place at Toms River at that time, in Ocean County at that time, where if you didn't have a fancy college education, you could get a blue-collar job that would pay you enough to raise your family, buy a house, and get a piece of the American dream. So that was very important because the community at that time was not a wealthy community at all. It was really struggling. There were chicken farmers, and there was a little bit of tourism. Wealthy families would come out for the summer from Philadelphia here or New York City. But in the main, it was a struggling place. And boy, when Toms River Chemical came in, which was the name of the company set up by Ciba and its partners, that was really the place to be.
And going back to the 50s and even the 60s, this is really before the EPA, before the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. What were the regulations when it came to pollution, environmental pollution?
Well, it was,
or were there?
It was pretty ambiguous. There were, in fact, regulations. Until the creation of the EPA and the major federal statutes in the early 1970s, environmental quality was really the domain of health departments, either the local health department or the county or the state health departments. And there were laws in New Jersey. Actually, New Jersey had, compared to other states, which had virtually nothing, New Jersey had some things on the books. But they were ambiguous, and they were rarely enforced.
Well, quoting from your book, you write, Ciba would dump it meaning the chemical waste, the toxic waste, on the factory grounds, all of it enough to fill more than 1,000 50-gallon drums every year. Drums were buried in pits and trenches or just dumped in unmarked clearings within a dense forest. Often the waste would not be contained at all.
Yeah, that's true. And that's just the solid waste. It was absolutely dwarfed by the wastewater, thousandfold increases, 1,000 times more was liquid. And it's just hard to fathom exactly how much waste was generated. And the reason is that dye was incredibly, making dyes inexpensively is an incredibly waste-intensive process. Mm. You know, you generate, depending on the dye, it could be 6 times, 8 times more waste than actual dye product, which is pretty extraordinary.
And so there's solid waste, and there was then liquid waste associated with this.
Correct. The solid waste would go into drums sometimes. Sometimes it would just be dumped in open pits. And the liquid waste allegedly was treated and then sent to holding ponds and then eventually sent into the Toms River. But what really happened was that these holding ponds had no bottoms, at least most of them didn't initially. And so the liquid waste would just seep right down, mostly untreated, into the sand and then into the aquifer and then into the Toms River, where it eventually did some serious damage to the water supply.
Well, indeed. In fact, people living around that area would describe the kind of stench that came out of their faucets, that the water just tasted bad. Even fish that was gotten from the waters had a weird taste. People that went swimming would get out of the water with this sort of weird purple foam on their body.
Right, right. A number of different things were happening. The purple foam was right by the discharge, but the smell was lasted for miles, depending on the unique conditions and what the plant was doing on that particular day. And what's interesting is that the people in the factory certainly knew it. The first water contamination was the factory's own wells, their own drinking water wells. So they knew what dye chemicals smelled like in drinking water because they had to shut down their own water fountains or move their water supply. So when folks from who lived at the factory happened to live in a neighborhood a quarter mile away, when they turned on their taps and started smelling the same thing in the late 1950s, they knew what was going on. Really more like the early 1960s, they knew exactly what was going on.
And you even describe a pipe that went into the ocean, directly into the Atlantic Ocean, but not far from, you know, a pretty well-known public beach.
Right. That was their big solution. They really made a mess of the Toms River. And Toms River is not a mighty river like the ones that had been previously polluted. Siba Geigy had made dyes in Switzerland, and it had polluted the Rhine, and it had made dyes in Cincinnati and polluted the Ohio. But those are big, vast rivers. The Toms River is just a little creek, especially near the plant. So there was a huge impact there, and when the town started to get angry about it, the company said, no problem, we have a solution. We're going to build a pipe, and instead of dumping directly into the river, we're going to dump into the ocean. So don't worry about it. The ocean's a big place. What they didn't count on was that eventually, when more and more people found out about it, especially in the shore communities, people got really upset because New Jersey is very protective. They're very territorial about their ocean waters, about their beaches. It's part of their identity.
This book is also about the numbers of children who developed cancers, including, and you begin the book with Michael Gillick, who was born in 1979 and very shortly after his birth was diagnosed with neuroblastoma.
Right. Neuroblastoma is a pretty common childhood cancer. Childhood cancer itself is relatively rare, which is why one of the reasons why it bothers us so much when we see it. But as far as childhood cancers go, neuroblastoma is a relatively common one. It's a cancer of the central nervous system. And Michael was diagnosed, and at the time that Michael was diagnosed, no one really thought that he would live. The doctors gave his parents a 50-50 odds that he would make it to his first birthday, so much so that they celebrated his birthday early. And his mother even purchased a coffin for Michael because she just thought that when the time came, she would just be too overwrought to do it. But Michael surprised everyone. He made it to his first birthday and then his second, and he's alive today and is a community activist with his mother. But he has been through absolute hell.
In what way?
Multiple surgeries, incredibly painful chemotherapy and radiation, terrible physical ailments, He's very small. His hormonal system is pretty damaged. I don't want to talk too much about the details of his condition, but it's a difficult life that Michael has. But what's really impressive about the Gillicks and about others is that they turned their private tragedy into a public crusade, and it's really very admirable mm-hmm. what they did. And none of this would have come to light if not for people like the Gillicks.
In fact, Linda Gillick, she seemed like she was kind of leading the charge among these families to try to figure out what was going on. I mean, he's obviously getting care for their children, but trying to figure out, where is this coming from? Why is this happening in our town?
That's right. She was one of the first people to sort of stand up and say, gee, it looks like there's a lot of cancer around here. And it just a function of her personality and the fact that she's very observant. She's a very outgoing person, a very smart person and savvy person. And she's the kind of person that wherever she would go with Michael, and Michael was in and out of the hospital dozens, scores of times when he was a child, every place she would go, she would ask around and talk to other parents. So much so that she founded a charity to help other families who are dealing with childhood cancer. And that charity still exists today. It's mm-hmm. called Ocean of Love, and I very much urge your readers to support it, Ocean of Love, based in Toms River. And it was just the nature of her personality to ask questions. And it seemed like every place she went, she saw people from Ocean County or Toms River. Whether she was here in Philadelphia at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia or at the big hospitals in New York City. And that didn't seem right to her. And she wasn't the only one. People from the local county health department started asking questions. It really stuck in people's craw. Gee, it seems like there's an unusual number of kids with cancer.
Well, we're almost up in a break here. In fact, and I do want to talk about a nurse here in Philadelphia who began to connect some of the dots. But I guess the phrase was, you know, here's another Toms River. That was a phrase that was used that people understood what that meant when a family would come in with a child with I guess, some form of cancer.
Right. Her name is Lisa Bornazian, and she was a nurse at CHOP, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which, after all, is a very eminent institution for treating childhood sickness, maybe the most famous in the world, with clientele from all over the world. And yet, Lisa noticed that what seemed to be an unusual number of children who were coming in came from Toms River. And that bothered her. She started asking questions.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Dan Fagan is our guest. We're talking about his new book. It's called Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And it's about the chemical plants that were located in Toms River back in the 1950s and the toxic legacy from those plants. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro proudly supports WHYY. The University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro offers a dedicated senior care unit in the emergency department and a unit designed to meet the needs of elderly patients who are hospitalized. It is staffed by a clinical team that specializes in caring for older patients. You can learn more about their approach to senior care at PrincetonHCS.org or at 1-888-742-7496.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this two-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
If you love high style in men's fashion, then you know the name Oswald Boateng. He says his own love affair with fashion goes way back.
I had my first bespoke suit made when I was about 5 years old.
We'll hear about the British designer's signature style next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Dan Fagan about his new book called Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. It's about the legacy of industrial pollution, its impact on this particular community, and the difficulty of tracking cancer clusters. Dan Fagan is speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the University of Pennsylvania Bookstore. That's in West Philadelphia at 3601 Walnut Street, but obviously joining us here in our Philadelphia studio at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So this nurse at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, so she noticed similar symptoms and children coming from similar locations. That's the kind of alarm that went off with her?
Yeah, that's right. The thing that really she noticed more than anything else is the location. That many, you know, this hospital got patients from all over the world, or certainly all over the greater, you know, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Maryland, Delaware area, and yet she kept seeing people who said they were from Tom's River, and she also noticed that many of them were brain or central nervous cases or central nervous system cancers or leukemias. Now, again, those are relatively common childhood cancers. But it bothered her, and she said something to the doctors. And the doctor said, well, don't worry about it. I'm sure it's just a coincidence. People are always seeing patterns that don't really exist. So just keep your head down, do your job. But that really bothered Lisa. She didn't want to just let it go. And as it happened, she had a sister-in-law, Laura Jansen, who worked for the Environmental Protection Agency, and they were at dinner one night. And Lisa told Laura about it, and Laura also thought that it was worth at least a telephone call. So she finally got the ball rolling. And, you know, the remarkable thing, Marty, is this is after 25 years of people being concerned about illness in Tom's River. And finally, it took this observant nurse and her sister-in-law to finally get things rolling and eventually have a full-blown investigation of the Toms River cluster.
In fact, Laura Johnson says at one point, I've been with the EPA for 23 years, and that one phone call, obviously from this nurse, may have been the biggest contribution I've made to the protection of public health and environment. That was my moment, I guess. That's a quote from your book.
Yeah, that's what Laura said. She's a great person, and she's certainly done like many, many other hardworking employees at the EPA. She's been involved in many things. But it's interesting how fate turned in this one example, and it led to something very big, something very important.
Your book is, though, also the difficulty in figuring out about cancer clusters. I mean, in part, cancer's quite a common, it's rare for children, but it's still a very common disease. What are some of the challenges of trying to figure out the cause and effect when it comes to cancer clusters?
Right. There are so many. You know, The very first people, and I spend a little bit of time in the book tracing the history of this, the very first people to really worry about the connections between the environment and disease, cancer was one of the first things they noticed. But once we started to understand germs, germ pastors, germ theory, and infection, the idea of infectious disease really arose, and we started to understand that in the 19th century, everyone realized that it was a heck of a lot easier to interpret and understand patterns of highly infectious illnesses like cholera or measles than it was to understand cancer. Cancer is a nightmare to try to figure out its causes. We think that cancer is one disease, but it's actually at least 150, depending on how you classify. Some people would say untold hundreds. Mm-hmm. Now that we're understanding individual genetic variants of larger diseases like breast cancer, there's a really long latency period too, Marty. Which
maybe
means
decades.
That, yeah, decades is probably a little too long, but often it's a decade between the triggering event or events and the appearance of a diagnosable tumor. That's so much time that the idea of somehow going back having a, you know, doing some time travel and trying to understand what caused that initiating event, you know, that this hit on DNA is extremely difficult to do. That's really hard. There's also the problem of trying to understand that when you see a cluster, trying to figure out, is that what we call a true cluster or a cluster created by chance? And that's a huge problem because we know, Marty, that things cluster naturally. You know, when you see birds flying across the sky, they're not evenly spaced across the horizon. They clump for no particular reason than just random chance. So this is a really tough problem.
Going back to Tom's River at the time, and there were, what, 69 children who were diagnosed with some form of cancer?
Yeah, even that number is really problematic. I mean, the reason that we 69 children were ultimately involved in the legal settlement right. is just has more to do with how the state conducted its investigation and which years it chose to encompass in its investigation that ultimately found that this was almost certainly not a random cluster, that it was a true cluster caused by something. And that cluster was identified as 69 children. But really, you could just as easily have expanded it to several hundred, depending on how you – the parameters that you pick. And then, of course, there's the question of, okay, well, what was the cause? If yes. we know – if we're pretty confident that it wasn't random, what was the cause? And that's the really hard work. And the amazing thing in Tom's River is that ultimately some likely causes were identified, which is something that almost never happens simply because the statistical problems are so difficult.
Another name that people should know is a guy named Jerry Fagliano. What was his contribution to this story?
Yeah, Jerry is a wonderful public servant. I don't know whether he's listening. He's probably hard at work. He works for the New Jersey Department of Health and Senior Services and is an epidemiologist there. And he ultimately conducted the investigation, took 4 years. It cost millions of dollars. There were lots of stops and starts and plenty of controversy and drama along the way. But he ultimately did identify some statistically significant associations between excess childhood cancer in Tom's River and particular environmental exposures related to two polluted sites in town. One was the factory that we've already talked about, and the other was a really horrible illegal dump that was ignored for many years until it contaminated one of the town's most important water supplies.
And that was on a farm, right? And a farm owned by an elderly couple?
It was. Well, they're elderly now. Yes, it was a chicken farm. I mentioned at the beginning of the show that chicken farming was very big. And you know, for the same reason that SEBA came to Tom's River for space, illegal dumpers came to Ocean County and surrounding areas because there was room for them just to dump. A very disreputable guy named Nick Fernicola took waste from Union Carbide, thousands of barrels, put it initially in the town landfill after paying some bribes to the town landfill folks. But then there were problems at the town landfill. There was an explosion. The town landfill guys wanted a bigger bribe. So Nick said, well, I think I've got another idea. So he approached this chicken farmer. Things were very rough. The farm was basically unused. And he had room out back. And so the farmer said, sure, you can use my land.
And did the chemical companies know that this was being done?
Well, there's some question about that. Certainly Union Carbide didn't try very hard to find out what was happening to the thousands of barrels of toxic waste that were being removed from its site in Bound Brook, about an hour to the north. Ultimately, they did find out. And when they did find out, they and the town authorities and the county authorities put a stop to it. But by that time, there was a huge amount of damage done.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Dan Fagan, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an associate professor of journalism, also director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at NYU. And he's got a new book called Tom's River. That's Tom's River, New Jersey. And it's subtitled A Story of Science and Salvation. It's about the legacy of industrial pollution, its impact on this particular community. And as he was just saying, some of the problems and difficulty of tracking things called cancer clusters. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. We get Fred from Forked River, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, Dan.
Hi, Fred.
I'm talking about things that I perceived years ago, and no one made mention of it. You spoke about the three different facets to the pollution: jumping at the farm, jumping on the plant site, and then the Toms River, and then the outfall line off of Wortley Beach. But what people don't talk about, and I believe a significant contributor to the pollution and spreading it, is that 10-mile outfall line. In 1985, Greenpeace came there and attempted to stop the line by plugging it. And they were successful in putting plugs in some of the holes, because you had an outfall line that went out and discharged.
Yeah, that's right. I described that process, exactly what they did in the book. They succeeded for a total of about 8 hours. But yes, they did.
Anything you want to add to that, Fred? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, briefly. What I'm thinking is they're plugging it from one end. Here's a 40-year-old pipe, which has got to have leaks in it, and the plant is pressurizing from the other end.
Yeah.
At every one of those joints along the 10-mile line, there's a nail in the groundwater. It had to be.
Yeah,
well,
Fred.
It's interesting. Fred, thanks.
Fred, I tell you why I don't think that that's the case. I don't think that is a significant source of contamination.
And let me just stop you there, because I just want to make sure our listeners, I mean, what Fred is saying is that, and Greenpeace did come there.
They did.
By plugging these pipes, they helped to create some of the damage?
Yeah, that's the allegation that Fred is making. I'll tell you why I don't think that that's significant. Because there was pretty significant monitoring. Once a couple of leaks were identified in the pipeline, and those first leaks were identified long before Greenpeace was there, and this became a big controversy, there was pretty significant groundwater monitoring along the route of the pipeline, and it never really found a lot. And beyond that, Greenpeace did not succeed in plugging all of the outfalls. There were always some outfalls. There were dozens of individual holes. Greenpeace plugged some of them. So I don't think that was a big problem. The pipeline itself, it's hard to say that was a major contributor to the illnesses in Toms River. On the other hand, the pipeline was a symbol of what the chemical company was doing, which is just trying to sort of push the waste away in a place where people wouldn't see it, and that they somehow wouldn't have to deal with their waste properly if they just sent it out to the ocean.
Fred, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. What would have been the proper, or what is the proper way to dispose of these toxic chemicals?
Well, today you couldn't do what SIBA and Toms River Chemical and its partners at Toms River Chemical did. You would have given a much higher level treatment, tertiary plus treatment, to the liquid waste, and the solid waste would have been shipped to a double-lined hazardous waste landfill, actually more than double-lined, with a elaborate monitoring system.
Hmm.
Ultimately, under severe pressure from the state and the EPA, SIBA did build a lined landfill, but that landfill was not supposed to be used for barrels of hazardous waste, and somehow hundreds, maybe thousands of barrels of hazardous waste somehow wound up in that landfill anyway. And as a result, SIBA was fined many millions of dollars. There was a criminal case that ultimately ended in a legal settlement. And SIBA spent tens of millions of dollars emptying out part of that landfill, but not all of it.
There was an extensive, or perhaps it's even ongoing, I'm not sure, but an extensive cleanup of some of this toxic material.
Yeah, that's true.
Was this considered a Superfund site?
It was. It was a Superfund site, and so was Reich Farm, the chicken farm where the illegal dumping was done. Both of those sites have mostly been cleaned up. But especially in the case of the SIBA plant, there was such a tremendous volume of chemical waste in the aquifer that they will be pumping for another 10, 15 years before water quality beneath the factory site meets EPA standards. So this is an epic cleanup that will last, you know, at least two generations.
So the pumps are still going?
They're still going today, and that's relevant because both Reich Farm and SIBA Geigy site are potential places for redevelopment, and the town has talked about that for a long time now, but it's hard to see people being particularly interested in purchasing a site or living on a site or even working on a site that is still a Superfund place.
And there was a settlement for these families.
There was a legal settlement for this family.
Unusual, right?
Yeah, it's even unusual. Today? It's unusual. It shows the strength of the evidence that the cluster was not random and the strength of the association to particular forms of pollution from the factory side and from Reich Farm. So there was a negotiated settlement. We don't know the exact amount, but it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $30, $35 million. And families, they got various amounts depending on the extent of their injuries. Some people got a $500,000, maybe $600,000, and some people got as little as maybe a little more than $100,000, mm-hmm. Some families that had cancer, where there was a child with cancer. So that was a very difficult and emotionally wrenching process. And it was negotiated by some attorneys here in Philadelphia and also by Jan Schlickman, who is some of your listeners will know as the person who John Travolta portrayed in A Civil Action. A lot of the hard work was done by Philadelphia attorneys at Williams Cooker Berezovsky, an excellent environmental law firm here in Philadelphia.
And about a minute before our second break, the response from New Jersey officialdom to this whole, I mean, we talked about people working for the health department and other departments as well. How about for state elected officials? Was there concern?
Yeah, at various times. Early on, the real concern was for the company that, you know, the idea was we've got to preserve these jobs, we've got to grow. And it wasn't just the elected officials. Many of the folks in Toms River really pursued an aggressive growth agenda, so much so that the water company was forever struggling to meet demand. So the last thing that the water company was interested in doing at that time was somehow worrying about spending money to improve the quality of its water or even shutting down contaminated wells. It was much more interested in making sure that there was enough water for people to mow their lawn, water their lawns, etc. Later, the political, you know, once there was sufficient public outrage, mm-hmm. many of the politicians really came around and made sure that there was sufficient money to do this fascinating scientific investigation.
And that's Dan Fagan, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Toms River. It's about Toms River, New Jersey, subtitled A Story of Science and Salvation. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lantern Theater Company presents Tom Stoppard's Heroes, extended through Sunday, June 16th. War heroes Gustav, Philippe, and Henri are plotting an escape. They've had enough of the tortures of their confinement, dictatorial captors, untrustworthy fellow prisoners, and far too many birthday parties. Indeed, life in a retired soldier's home is almost unbearable. Veteran actors Peter Delorier, Dan Kern, and Mal White star in Stoppard's playful and heartbreakingly funny comedy. Details online at lanterntheater.org.
Just about everyone knows the song Gimme Shelter, but not many people think about who's singing the backup vocal. It's Mary Clayton, one of the backup singers featured in the new documentary about backup singers, 20 Feet from Stardom. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Clayton and the film's director, Morgan Neville. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. On the eve of the Iranian elections, an Iranian-American restaurant owner returns from Tehran with mixed feelings about leaving and suitcases filled with spices. Also, a new report shows that CO2 emissions in the U.S. are dropping, but around the world they're at record highs. Is it too late to avoid a disaster? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Dan Fagan is our guest. He's an associate professor of journalism, also director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at NYU. His new book, which we have been talking about, is called Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation, and he's speaking tonight at 6 at the University of Pennsylvania Bookstore. That's at 3601 Walnut Street. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me quote something else from the book that you write about Siba Geigy, when all these, you know, people were beginning to figure out what was going on and they had a public relations problem on their hand. You say the company responded with all the finesse and humility of Marie Antoinette on the eve of the French Revolution, a kind of let them eat cake response. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they still thought that they were dealing with the traditional docile, eager for jobs community that they were dealing with all through the 50s and mostly the 1960s. But by the 1980s, the worm was starting to turn. People really started to realize that there was a lot of talk about cancer in the community. There was talk about cancer among the workforce at Tom's River Chemical. And the company quickly realized by the mid-1980s that the kind of tap dancing that they had done early wasn't going to fly this time. It still took a really long time to shut down that pipeline and eventually shut down the plant, and even longer to come to grips with the health consequences of what had happened in Tom's River. But that was certainly a turning point.
Something else, and this is again Siba Geigy, and you write, the 5 million gallons per day of treated waste that the company was pumping into the ocean, and this was a representative from Siba Geigy, declared were harmless because the effluent was composed of, quote, 99% water and a little salt. In other words, you write, all the company was doing was putting salt and water into a saltwater ocean. That right. was their description.
Right. That was that. That really raises a larger point, too, and that is that there's kind of a patronizing attitude when it comes to complex subjects like environmental health. And whether it's a company or whether it's a government official, a lot of people out there, you know, take the attitude that, well, this stuff is too complicated for you little people to possibly understand. So just leave it to us, and we'll just give you the pablum. We'll give you the sort of benign PR, and you just swallow it and keep your head down and do your job. And the story of Tom's River is really the story of people who decided that they weren't going to be satisfied with that. And I'm happy to say that that pattern is sometimes repeated in other places too. And I see it happening right now in China. And it's both scary what is happening there, but also just at least a little bit encouraging that people are starting to look around and speak up. And I was thrilled that my book is going to be published in Chinese.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that was really important to me.
Is that because a lot of these chemical plants have moved their plants to China?
It absolutely is the case. China, 25 years ago, was a tiny, tiny player in the chemical industry, and now it is the absolute dominant player. BASF alone, the company that as the successor company to Siba Geigy, BASF is the largest chemical company in the world. They have dozens of plants in China. Dow, which swallowed up Union Carbide, also has a huge presence in China. Why? Well, partly it's because labor costs are low. Partly it's because manufacturing takes place there, finished manufacturing, and so raw material manufacturing chemicals make sense to locate that near. But a fundamental reason is because environmental protection is so poor and health monitoring is so primitive, and the population is so desperate for economic development, especially in the interior, which is where a lot of this manufacturing takes place.
And they're probably less litigious than Americans are?
Absolutely. It's an authoritarian society. When the government has made no bones about the fact that its policy is to encourage industrial development as rapidly as possible. And that is not a completely irrational policy either. There's, you know, we don't have famines in China anymore. And part of the reason is because of the incredible development that's occurred there. But now the Chinese people are starting to wake up to the consequences.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Al from Fairmount joining us on Radio Times. Al, go ahead. You're on the air.
I was just wondering if Toms River is not a cautionary tale for us in Pennsylvania with the influence of the promise of jobs and such versus the environmental consequences of fracking here.
Of fracking, yeah. Well, have you looked at fracking?
Yeah, I've certainly thought about it. Right. I can't say that I've written much about it because I've been so focused on this book. You know, many people ask me about that, and I do think that there are some important lessons. Toms River is indeed a cautionary tale of looking before you leap, of making sure that the industry doesn't control the data, that there's independent data and independent analysis, and that there's strong regulation, not only in the sense of what's on the books, but what's actually happening in the field. You know, we have our, at least on paper, environmental protection in the United States is much stronger than it was when the worst of the Toms River offenses occurred. But I'm very concerned that we're stripping our regulatory agencies. We're overworking the people who are left. We have lots of things on the books that we don't actually enforce. So I think that it's incumbent on states like Pennsylvania that are upstate New York, other places that either are considering or already deep into fracking, to make sure that there is aggressive, independent, and efficient environmental regulation. I'm not ready to say that fracking is a terrible idea. I definitely have concerns about it. But I also think that natural gas is way better than coal for other environmental reasons. So it's a complex topic, but one thing that is absolutely clear is that we need aggressive, proactive environmental regulation. So we don't wait. We don't find ourselves doing after the fact investigation, you know, figuring out what caused the fire after the fire has already burned the house down.
Al, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm also wondering about going back to the 1950s and these chemical companies in Toms River. Seems we are making many, or we use many more chemicals today than we did 50 or 60 years ago. Am I right or wrong about that? Or is there any way to know?
Yeah, it's hard to say. We certainly use a wider palette of chemicals, that's for sure. We have managed to get rid of some of the most destructive industrial practices, many of them, not all of them. And many of the more destructive ones we've gotten, at least they're out of sight in the sense that they're occurring either in very poor communities in the American South or especially overseas in places like India, Indonesia, and especially China. But are we using more? Yeah, I guess we are using more. But it would be wrong to say that the situation is worse now here, you know, on the East Coast of the United States than it was in the 50s and 60s. That's not the case. On the other hand, we still have plenty of work to do.
Let me get Andrea from New Britain to join us. Andrea, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I work in the hazardous waste treatment industry, so although oftentimes we're perceived as villains, we actually are the companies that take care of this waste properly and now that our industry is in existence. So my question is, you know, I feel like, you know, we haven't had any new facilities permitted. It's difficult to add new technology for 20 to 30 years. A lot of the existing infrastructure is pretty old. And so my question is, we need to have an honest conversation about where we go in the future, because I'm concerned if we continue to consume like we do, we need a place to properly send waste. And, you know, I don't know that we're being proactive and no one in the community wants anything near them to properly handle this waste.
It's a great point, Andrea. Thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, Andrea's right. Basically the way that we've dealt with this problem largely is by punting, you know, by sort of saying, okay, we want the benefits of the cornucopia of synthetic molecules that the chemical industry has produced, but we don't want to deal with the consequences. And we've done that largely by shifting production to other places. That doesn't mean that we're completely immune, though, because after all, consumption and ultimate disposal of these consumer products also creates some risk. So Andrea's point is a good one. So it's part of a larger problem, and that is that so much environmental policy in the United States has just been stalled. We have not had a particularly significant piece of environmental legislation, arguably since the 1980s, maybe the mid-1990s if you count the Food Quality Protection Act, but we really haven't done much. We've been mired. We've been stuck. And so what I always say to people is, really the most important thing you can do for the environment is to support campaign finance reform, because we've got to get our government unstuck. We need a transparent, open, independent regulatory system. And we're not going to be able to do that until we reduce reduce the influence of special interests in Washington.
Let me get Andrew. Thanks for the call. Let's see what John from Morrisville has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Great book. I was wondering what's the current state of the water supply in Toms River today.
I'm glad you asked that question.
Thanks,
because. I gave a talk at Toms River a couple of months ago, and I was really concerned about that people were either going to be panicked or furious. And they were neither of those things, because they know that actually Toms River's water is okay. It's certainly no worse than what one would expect for the general region there in central New Jersey. And there's a simple reason for that, and that is because everything that the town has gone through has led to a huge amount of attention being paid to the quality of the water in Toms River. It's often said that it's the most elaborately, extensively tested water in all of New Jersey, maybe all of the country. I don't know about that, but I do know that there's no particular reason for anyone in Toms River to be concerned about the quality of their water. And that's the last thing that I would want people to take away from this book. Instead, what I want people to take away from this book is that Toms River happens to be the place that we know about. We know that this happened in Toms River due to some really terrible luck and also some incredible bravery by lots of people who we've already discussed. My own view is that there are hundreds, thousands of other Toms Rivers that we don't know about. And so I hope that people will read this book and apply its lessons in their own hometowns.
Thanks for the call, John, not to Radio Times. Looking at Toms River, have the number of cases of leukemia and cancer, have they gone down over time as this cleanup has taken place in Toms River?
Yes, they have. It's a murky question. It's a murky picture, as I explain in the last chapter. Leukemia, which was the crucial one and the one that was most statistically elevated, has declined, which certainly supports the hypothesis that the water, contaminated water from Reich Farm, and also air pollution from Siba Geigy were an important cause of excess childhood cancer cases in the 90s and the 2000s. So they've gone down nicely. On the other hand, there's been kind of a weird increase in overall cancers. That it's hard to know exactly what that means. It certainly shows how difficult it is to interpret these patterns. And it's a very short-term move up, and now it's moving back down. Mm. So that could very well be just a function of bad luck. The overall picture is that the evidence is not crystal clear, but it's solid that the number of that the cancer risk to children in Toms River is declining, as one would expect once these environmental problems were correct.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. This is Barry from Westchester. Barry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I have land out in West Town, Chester County in Pennsylvania. About 40 years ago, I remember, after getting out of the Army, seeing a chemical truck dumping chemicals in a lagoon. Eventually, it came to court. They were indicted. It was Chemical Lehman. but this was 40 years ago. I still have that land. There's no real estate on it, but they have developed around it. Just wanted to know if there's any statute of limitations on getting a municipality to run fresh water, municipal water, to that property. Hmm. I'll just take it off the air.
Barry, thanks for the call. I mean, I know things can vary from township to township.
Right. That's what I was going to say. I think that you would have to show, my guess, it very much depends on the local laws, but my guess is that you would have to show continuing contamination. You would have to show a current risk. If you could show a current risk, even if the dumping occurred long, long ago, if you can, you know, show that there is current contamination, you could well succeed in a civil suit. If you can't, if the contamination was solely in the past and you can't measure it now, I think it would be more difficult. But I'm not a lawyer, mm-hmm. and it very much depends on the local laws and local conditions.
Barry, thanks for your call to Radio Times. And Dan Fagan, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
That was great. Thank you very much.
It was great for us as well, and congratulations on your book. Dan Fagan, Associate Professor of Journalism, Director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. He's also the author of this book that we've been talking about called Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And again, he's speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the University of Pennsylvania Bookstore, and that's at 3601 Walnut Street in West Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program, including a Facebook and podcast, email, archives. It's all there, whyy.org/radiotimes. Jessica Crocker, our intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.